Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today, it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Edie Nathan. Edie Nathan, MA-LCSW, CST, is a licensed psychotherapist. She's a certified sex therapist and grief expert who guides people through the terrain most avoid, grief, trauma, and sexuality. With master's degrees from New York University in Fordham and certification in sex therapy from the University of Michigan, Edie brings clinical depth and grounded compassion to the conversations we're often too afraid to have. She believes healing begins in what is called the innermost cave, a place where one meets their greatest obstacles and finds the tools for deep transformation. She says being in the cave means you're daring to live with your loss. It's where the shadows of grief, mourning, and the traumatic imprint reveal themselves, and given the chance, it will transform you. This is the heart of her work, not just surviving grief, but partnering with it, dancing with it, and emerging changed. Edie is the author of It's Grief, The Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss, and is currently writing her second book, Dare to Live, The Sexual Grief Effect, Reveal the Shadow Wounds from Loathing to Liberation to Love. Her message is clear. It's time to dare to live. You have the power. You've had it all along. And amen to all of that, Edie. And with that, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I got to tell you, when you talked about the innermost cave, when I read your bio, the first thing that came into mind is shamans, and that shamans will go into the innermost cave to get into the dark and to decide the darkest parts of themselves and come out reborn. And the cave, I think in some cultures, and correct me if I'm wrong, is symbolic of rebirth.
Absolutely. Rebirth. Part of the innermost cave is it started with Plato, but it was kind of redirected by Joseph Campbell in his work through the hero's journey. And the hero's journey is an interesting one in that it aligns so well with loss and the pain of grief and the surprise that grief forever changes you. And that rhythm, the walk that one takes is in that hero-shiro journey is that something happens that forever changes you and you can't go back. You just can't go back. And you're now on a path, and that path takes you through a lot of different challenges, if you will. And you land in the innermost cave. Plato called it inmost cave. And in that place is where we meet our shadows, where we meet our obstacles, where we're, you know, with our swords, if you will, our emotional swords, our physical swords, the ones that we using to defend ourselves and hold on to ourselves as much as we possibly can. And it is truly a heroic journey, but it is a place where we kind of strip down and naked, and we're seeing ourselves in ways that we may never have imagined. And we're asked, the big ask, the universal ask, to see where we're stuck, to see what we lost in that relationship. And that relationship can be the relationship to the lost loved one. It could be to the pet. It could be to the limb that you lost because of an accident. And it could also be the loss of self. And then you move out of the cave and you keep going and you're forever changed, but you look the same and your voice sounds the same. But perhaps the people who are now on your next journey, if you will, some of them have changed, some of them have left, and new ones have come in.
Yeah, and that's the thing about grief. It's not a static process. It's very much like we talked before we started to record. It's very much not linear. It's circular. Grief can resurface at any time, you know, during our life cycle because relationships are permanent. We carry those relationships with us. And the thing that I found, no matter what losses I have had, whether it's been pets, whether it's been children, whether it's been parents, the bottom line is that every loss has forever changed the landscape of who I am. Every relationship is unique, and it's changed me. And to say that it hasn't changed me, I'd be either in denial or I'd be lying, because it has. And I never would have wanted to have my worst tragedy or you know, to define who I was or to really be the catalyst for the evolution of myself. But the bottom line is, Edie, it is. And we don't have any control over the challenges that befall us in this lifetime. And I've said this on my podcast. I've said this on other podcasts. It's what we do with them and how we choose to be transformed with them and then be of service and try to be of help to others, to me, is the key with all of that.
Well said. Yeah.
So tell our audience who Edie Nathan is. How did you get on this path of grief? What were the experiences that contributed to you embracing grief as kind of your life's work?
You know, there are times in one's life where, as we're talking about grief, you don't choose grief, it chooses you. And I would say that that's the same with this life's work. It's not that I chose it. It's just that I had to do it. Yeah. I had to do this work. And I didn't start out doing this work, although it's curious because what I started out doing was the theater and acting and taking on different roles. And from yay high, I just loved embodying different characters, and I would play act all of the time. And I think, though, in hindsight, and after a lot of therapy and my own deep dives, you know, into my inmost cave, I realized that it was a far easier to be other people, other characters, and that those early choices were actually choices that were about grief and about the loss of somewhat of myself, having been pretty terribly bullied as a kid and being a trauma survivor, and also just living in an environment that from an external lens, it looked like probably like a fairy tale, but not all fairy tales, as we know, there's always like the arch enemy, right? And so those roles really enabled me to survive. And when I was 27, my partner died, and though he was much older than me, he was very, very important to me. And he actually taught me what it was to be loved. Now, it's not that I could hold on to that, but he taught it to me, and he taught me what unconditional love was in a big way. And he was an actor, and though we didn't really act together because he was on his way to Broadway, he was an amazing teacher for me, and I could learn so much about the work. And when he died, I was finishing up school, and I was going to go into corporate training, and I was going to use my theater skills in corporate training, and I looked for help. And I see you shaking your head. And I was 27, and I couldn't find. What I found were platitudes, Dave. I found cruelty. I found, well, you're young, don't worry, you'll find someone. And it was like, all I wanted to do was vomit, you know? I was in so much pain. I don't want to just go and find someone. I need to work on myself. I need to heal a little bit. And that was when I started my journey into grief and loss, and I found a way to incorporate my understanding and knowledge of the work of theater, and then doing the research around grief and studying how people grieved around the world to bring in more creative methods to find a way to talk about something that we often don't have words for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was shaking my head because, you know, yeah, I mean, what we got back then was platitudes. Well, you know, you can find another relationship. It's like telling a woman who has miscarried their child that you could have another child. That's just a lost pregnancy. Well, no, it isn't. It's a lost child.
That's right.
Or somebody asking a parent, well, how many other kids do you have, knowing that their child that they're concerned about is going to die of a terminal illness. But I think most of the time, Edie, most people don't intend to be insensitive. I just think they don't know what to say. That is, I think, starting to shift. I think I'm seeing more books in terms of that are more for individuals who are trying to support our bereaved loved ones, to try to say, here's how you hold space. Here's how you become a companion. Here's how you offer support without undermining their pain, undermining their grief journey. But back in the day, there wasn't any of this. It was, and this is one of the reasons we need to talk about grief. Not so much because we need to make death a normalized part of the conversation, but also in terms of this is how we support somebody who's going to go through the inevitable pain of losing somebody they love, or losing a limb, losing a part of themselves due to an accident, going through a divorce. Grief comes in all forms.
A wonderful researcher, Dr. Ken Doka, came up with the term disenfranchised grief. Yep. And it's about the grief that's not necessarily socially acceptable. And it's a grief we don't talk about or hold space for. And that can be pet loss. It can be job loss. It can be, you know, frankly, and he doesn't necessarily talk about this, but the loss of libido or the loss of a child or women going through menopause. I mean, there are losses that get incurred.
You know, and another loss that does not get talked about enough is infertility loss.
Yes. And then, you know, once you bring up infertility, what a woman goes through to get pregnant, mm-hmm. you know, utilizing all of the skills of medicine, but drugs that are moving through their bodies in order for the union between sperm and the egg to actually come together within their womb, but what they have to do and what they are feeling and the heightened emotions and for some weight gain, for some incredible moodiness. And it's like they have been taken over and their partners often are at a loss with what to do, how to respond. And that's grief, you know, that's grief.
Yeah, and I know too, particularly, you know, I was talking to my wife, you know, we had three children. And she said, every time I found out I was pregnant, that child became my child, period. And that's why I tell my students, I tell anybody who will listen, miscarriage loss is child loss. It's not a lost pregnancy.
That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, and then there's the loss of adoption, you know, and we don't necessarily talk about that either. And it's a very intense loss. I call it the triad. And the triad loss is that the birth mother gives up the child. That's the first loss. The child is going into a family that wanted a child, probably couldn't get pregnant. And so they're going into a family looking for that child to make it all better.
Yep.
And then that child has the loss of having been given up and having to perform a role, be in the role of like savior.
Yep.
And it is complicated.
And I know too, there's the foster parent who has raised a child or has helped raise a child, and that child leaves the home. They find out that child died. That's grief that doesn't get talked about either.
That's right.
You know, so
and sometimes the responses, and as you said, people often don't know how to respond. Yeah. And one of the things that I suggest is when you don't know how to respond, just be there in presence. You don't have to say anything. A lot of times when someone is mourning and it's mourning for the loss of a loved one, let's say, and a lot of people the first month, the first 2 months, the first 3 months, food, lots of phone calls. At about the 3 to 4 month mark, all of that drops off. Yeah. And if you're a good friend, that's when you really start to show up. Yeah. And let's go for a walk. I'm going to just come over and spend some time with you. Or I'm going to just write a note and just say, thinking about you today. And just wanted you to know, doing little tiny moments of connection can be incredibly helpful. 3-4 months in, and mark it on the calendar, because we forget, because we get involved in the living of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. But, and then the 3 to 4 months, we're still trying to figure out what type of world we want to live in, what type of a person we're going to be.
That's right.
And work on accepting a world where our loved ones are not physically present. And that the work goes on for us and for everybody else. They just reengage in their
Absolutely.
World as normal. So
that's right. And talk about that hero Shiro's journey. You're forever changed. And you may decide, as the person who is now dancing with this grief, the idea of the dance metaphor is that dance does change you, should you decide that you're actually going to integrate it. Because the integration of the grief is not a story that gets written, that it comes in and then it's gone. Because then I would be saying, which is why I hated when my partner Paul died, and people were like, oh, there's going to be some closure and then you'll get on with your life. And it's like, closure meant that, like, I'm done and that's it. And it's like, no. I'm going to integrate this. I want to integrate it. My stories with Paul will forever be a lie. Yeah. So if someone has decided to do that integrative partnership, then they empower themselves by teaching the people around them that they are in this integrative partnership with their grief, and that sometimes it's going to be really intense, and then other times it may not be as intense, but it doesn't mean that you've forgotten.
No. You know, Maurice Schwartz was one of my favorite Maurice Schwartz quotes: death ends a life, not a relationship. And relationships are ongoing. And I mean, for me, what I've been able to do is, for my process of integration, is take the best parts of who my ancestors are, make them a part of me, and symbolically, I move forward with them.
I love that. Yeah.
And this way, they're always with me, and I'm moving forward in my grief, but with them, kind of as my partners in grief. So they're always with me. And one of the most tragic losses I had was having a daughter transition over 22 years ago due to cancer. And I tell my students, I said, if you see a lot of young energy coming out of me, it's because that's my daughter's influence, because I've taken the best parts of her, made them a part of me. But that's not only just with her, it's with all of my ancestors. So that they're kind of like this community of souls within, and they're all part of my internal oneness, which helps me redefine my life narrative, which is why, you know, evolution of grief is ongoing. If you asked me, Edie, who I was 22 years ago, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't even tell you who I was 22 hours ago. The transformation could be that stark. But we have to be open to that integrative piece. And to me, that's part of the dance that we do. I think for me, that was my dance, was trying to discover, okay, how can I kind of redefine my narrative, move forward with meaning, move towards acceptance, not closure, acceptance of the fact that this is my life the way it's going to be, and I'm going to reestablish myself in that life and find meaning. How am I going to do this? But I'm sure you have more, I guess, insight in terms of what that dance of self-discovery looks like in grief. Can you go with that a little more for us?
It's different for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the way, Dave, that you went through this and the losses that you've had, and certainly your daughter's loss, which was huge, so big, so forever life changing. And yet even the fact that we're talking about her, she's here, you know. And what was her name?
Janine.
Janine, okay. Janine has entered the room with us. And she do really believe in energy. And I really believe that we need to speak the names of the people we've lost. Mm. And with people who don't know us even. And that part of that integrative part, and I hear that you said acceptance. I had a really hard time with two words, closure and acceptance. And when we were talking earlier, I used the word integration, but there's another word that I've been playing around with quite a bit, which is homecoming. And that, how do we come home to ourselves, having experienced something that forever changed us? And that the homecoming is unlike any homecoming, because we're in discovery of who we are and the roles that we're playing. And, you know, I have Paul's Time X watch. It's something that he wore on his wrist all of the time. And it's one of some folks who are listening may not even remember, but it was a wind up watch, right?
Yep.
And when on his birthday or our anniversary, or even if I just had a memory pop up, then I'll wind the watch and I'll just hear it go tick, 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 tick. And it's a memory and I see it on his wrist. And it's not that it takes me back to a pain point where I can't function. It actually makes me remember the love. And then it supports the work, because there are days, and I don't know this for sure, but I would guess that there are days that are hard. And there are days that it's like, this is just way too much. And on those days, it's really good to remember why we're doing this work and why this topic is so important. And so when you say, you know, like, what do you say to people? I think it's be in discovery, be in your curiosity, and talk to the people who you feel safe enough to talk with. And it may be surprising, because you may get reactions from people who were besties, but there's something in the way that they're talking to you which makes you feel unseen or unsafe. And it doesn't mean that they're not doing the best they can, and yet something within you has so viscerally changed that the way you see the world and the impermanence / permanence of the losses changes how, what you will and won't tolerate, or what you engage in, or even how you take care of yourself.
Yep. And one of the things that I discovered in my own journey with loss is that my relationship circle changed. There were people that stepped up that I never thought would step up. There were people that stepped back that I never thought would step back. So those people that stepped back and weren't as supportive of me, I had to keep them outside of my support circle and welcome those people that came in. And a lot of times in early grief, and I'm sure you've heard this, people will lament about, well, the people that I thought were going to be there weren't there. Well, take a look at the people who are there. And that's what you work with. Maybe the people who aren't there might at some point come back into the circle when they're ready to handle your grief, but they may not be ready to do that right now. But focus on those people that are saying, here, I'm willing to be present. I'm willing to be a sounding board. I'm willing to go to the store for you, you know, when you need groceries. Those are the ones, people that you hang on to, and you build your support circle from there.
That's right. Or pick up the kids from school, or take them. Or, hey, why don't you have a night alone? I'm happy to take the kids and have a sleepover. So there's a lot of different ways for people who feel helpless to help. And it's about mapping what's going on. And that word mapping is important. You're assessing, you're reading the situation, not doing something that you think should be done, but rather what is needed in this specific situation. And also just to do a check-in and to say, you know what, if I don't hear from you in like 2 days, I'm just going to check in. I just want to hear your voice. And if I just hear a hello, I'm okay. I'll just leave you alone, but I just want to make sure that you're okay.
Yeah, and I think it's just those little things that we can do.
Absolutely. It's those little things. Yeah.
Well, one of the things in terms of reading about your background and talking with you briefly, I know your grief lens is very different. So what is it about your lens of grief that is different from, let's say, other grief workers, other coaches? Expound on that a little bit.
Well, there are some folks who, I'm not saying many, and I'm sure your audience has already heard this, but, you know, there are some people who still ascribe to the notion of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And those five stages were brilliant, okay? I loved her work. I actually was able to do an intensive with her at one time in Michigan. She was remarkable and will always remain remarkable in my heart and in my brain because she just was life-changing for so many people on so many different levels because of the other work that she also did, the spiritual work that she got into really after her, you know, her amazing work and energy devoted to the dying. But truly, her five stages were about what the dying were going through. And it was linear. It was not a non-linear process per se. You know, there was denial and then the acceptance, that last stage was closure. They were about accepting, closing in on the life you had and finding a certain grace in the loss of your life, whatever that means. And, you know, it continues to be our greatest mystery of what death is. You know, we have a lot of ideas about it. But that frame has been converted for the people who are living with grief. And so part of what I love to talk about is that, you know, grief is nonlinear. We know this. We talk about that it's nonlinear. It swirls around us. And nonlinearity means that it doesn't follow a path, right? Yeah. And it can, all of the different emotions and experiences can come together, and the intersection of them can be mind-blowing so that there can be, and I've written about what I call the 11 phases, and we can certainly do a deeper dive into them. But what I see is that first phase is what I call the emotional armor phase. And the reason I call it emotional armor is because that's exactly what's going on. We are armoring ourselves, our brain, our prefrontal cortex, our amygdala, you know, our brainstem. There, everything is working in accordance to let's protect this person who is in incredible pain, and we need to do something, and let's all gather and help them shut down. And the way that we're going to help them shut down is we're going to give them some numbness and some shock and some, you know, dysregulation and some resilience, because it takes some resilience to do that. And some, you know, I don't know, did I say denial? And so we've got these, all of these parts of this emotional place, armor place. And what I see within this emotional armor place is that it is still part of the nonlinearity, in that we people go back there to regather the self. And so they have an epiphany. They start to deal with the anger and the anxiety, though they're two different phases from my perspective, because they can be felt alone, but oftentimes are very, very much, you know, having a conversation. And you start to deal with the anxiety and the anger, and then all of a sudden there's like some epiphany, and what do? You go back to the emotional armor phase because you need that respite. And so I see this as forever moving, and that these 11 phases, my last phase is grace. And the phase before that, I've actually, as I said, been changing some terms, is homecoming. And that is part of an integrative process, but you're coming home to the self. But just because you come home to the self and just because you reach grace doesn't mean that you like thought about what part of you might want to forgive. And it may be the reaction you had to the news that your loved one was dying, or the news that something was going to really change in your life and there was going to be an extreme loss. Maybe there is a forgiveness that's needed. And maybe just because there are 11 phases, it doesn't mean you're going to experience them all. But the ones you experience, you're going to partner with. And because what we know, let's say, Dave, we talk about anxiety. When we push anxiety away and say, no, I don't want to feel you. No, get away. It hurts too much. What happens when you push it away?
This comes back.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Debbie Ford. I don't know if you've read The Dark Side of the Light Chasers by Debbie Ford.
Yes,
where
yes.
She really takes Carl Jung's shadow element and makes it just a brilliant, brilliant work in terms of how to really come to your authentic self. But one of
That's
the things
right.
she talked about was this analogy of having a beach ball in like a pan of water. You suppress that beach ball. Let's say that beach ball is like your grief or any type of emotion you're experiencing as a result of grief, anger, guilt, whatever that may be, and you suppress it. When you let up on that ball just a little bit, it's going to come back up.
Oh, yeah.
And then you can get everybody who wants you to be okay now and move on. You can all get them to come down and suppress that negative emotion. I'll be happy to have you do that because they want to see you happy. But then when one of them lets up on that ball comes up. So the message is, look, I'm not going away. So let me make friends with me. Let me be your teacher. Let that shadow part of yourself see the gift in that shadow part of your grief so that you can come to your true, and I'm going to use your terminology, homecoming.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And when a lot of times, you know, the anger part, so you don't deal with the anxiety and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and it just says feed you, right? And then the anger is often right there. And what I learned, and I learned this, actually, I had a pretty severe anxiety disorder when I was in my 20s and to the point where I couldn't leave my house. And I lived on Flatbush Avenue in New York City in Brooklyn. I was living in this building and it was a rickety area. And all I had to do was walk down one flight of stairs. And it was just so hard for me to do this. My anxiety was just overwhelming. So I was finally starting to get better. I was finally starting to go out. I was on a subway, maybe my second or third subway ride. And it was like there were moments of awakening. I was just on the subway and I was just trying to hold on to myself. And my anxiety was there. And I just had to go three more stops. And it was at a time when chains were being stolen on the New York subways. And this guy comes at my neck to take the chain off of my neck. And we're moving. And out of nowhere, and I'm not going to swear on your show, but out of nowhere, I came and I grabbed his hand and I said, don't you dare, expletive before dare. And then I got off the train before the stop that I was supposed to get off at. And that meant that I was going to have to walk. And I was so furious that the anxiety was gone. I need to tap into my anger and what my anger is about. And maybe my anxiety will then dissipate. And so there's a lot sometimes for someone to be angry at when they're going through the imprints that grief leaves and how someone decides to transition, how someone leaves things maybe in a mess, wills weren't done, things are in probate. I mean, there's a whole slew of things that can go on. And instead of showing the anger, it turns into the anxiety. And then anger for something that's perhaps happening to your body or something that's happening to your family that you can't control that creates grief. And so part of this work is saying you can choose, you don't have to do anything. You can choose to be curious and partner with all these different phases.
Yes, because all of that makes us who we are. It isn't just a happy moments, it's everything. We're a microcosm, I think as Debbie Ford mentioned, we're a microcosm to the macrocosm.
That's
we have
right.
Every emotion, every thought, positive or negative, and if we mirror that to each other authentically, we're in service to each other.
That's exactly right.
Because if we look at it objectively, we can embrace our more authentic selves. So your book, It's Grief, The Dance of Self-Discovery Through Trauma and Loss. When people buy it who are grieving, what do you want them to take away from it?
So one of the things that's different about this book is there's a whole section called Me, Myself, and I. And in that section, it's about how grief kind of allows you, if you so choose, to learn about who you are in the process. And so in this Me, Myself, and I, there's like three different aspects of the self. And those three different aspects of the self are you, in terms of your emotions, and this can switch, okay? So it's not one or the other or the other. Are you over-distanced with your emotions, which means you don't express them. You keep them in. People can't map you or read what's going on. Or are you under-distanced where you're just displaying all of the emotions? And the goal, I think, ultimately, is to find that calibration. I don't know, Dave, if you as a kid were ever on a seesaw, but it's that seesaw, right? And trying to use it, and it takes two people to be on a seesaw to get that place where both feet are off the ground and you found that calibrated place. And grief is, that's the goal I see, as it's not that you're completely still in stasis, but instead you've got little movements rather than big jarring movements. So I would say that's one piece. The other is, are you fixed? Are you mutable? Are you a cardinal personality? And, you know, fixed is as it sounds, and mutable, like, you know, you just want a lot of people around to help you. And cardinal is kind of like, I can do this on my own. Again, these are like assessments to like who you are. And so that's two of the assessments. And so I would say getting to know the self and doing those self-assessments are very different than any grief book out there, and also using the archetypes.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, Carolyn Meese did something I know a lot with archetypes, particularly as it relates to personality. And
yes.
There's a lot of symbolism in archetypes, and there's a lot of spiritual awareness, knowing which That's archetypes right. manifest most in our situations, which have manifested in our grief, and which can manifest in, again, using your terminology, in our homecoming after loss. So, Edie, we're just about coming close to our time, and I could talk to you for about another hour or so.
Yeah, it's been great.
This has been fun for me too. But if you're going to leave our listeners with one ultimate takeaway today, what would that be?
You have the power all along. And really where that comes from is The Wizard of Oz. And I'm a storyteller. I love my stories. And in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy finds herself in a pickle. And there's a lot of grief. And she's left home, literally and symbolically, and that there's a grief for what she is leaving, maybe her childhood, but she must go on a path. And she meets different aspects, I think, of the parts of her that need to be developed in the Scarecrow, in the Tin Man, and in the Lion. And then we've got the Wizard. But at the very beginning, she's given these red shoes, which in the book were actually white, but in the movie, they were red. So we're going to go with the movie, and she needs to meet the part of her that needs her brains, the part of her that needs her heart, and the part of her that needs her courage. And grief is not for the faint of heart, and we don't choose it. And we need our brains, and we need our hearts, and we need our courage. It's a courageous journey. And we want to believe that there's a wizard that's going to cure it. But truly, the one who heals us is ultimately us. And that those red shoes, the ones that you walk in every single day, whatever they are, the steps you take to survive in the life that you have right now, you have to kind of go through. You choose to go through all of this. And then you have the power of the shoes. And you've always had that power. And to understand that you've got the power to move with this, to invite it in, and instead of thinking that your life might feel over, that maybe there are some new beginnings here where you get to learn about yourself and you get to pay the life forward, or whatever the loss is, forward as you partner with it. You have the power all along.
I like that. And so often grief can be so disempowering, loss can be disempowering. We forget that everything we need to succeed, we already have it. That has to be nurtured after grief in a community that's going to support it. And we have to believe in ourselves and the power of change, transformation, and homecoming.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dave. This was quite enjoyable today on a topic that people don't want to talk about.
That's right. But as long as you and I and Ken Doka and the other grief workers of the world are around, this grief is always going to be something that is going to be talked about. It's going to stay in awareness. Now, for people who want to get in touch with you, purchase your book, find out more about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that?
Best way to get the book, you can get it on Amazon. You can order it through Barnes & Noble, or go to one of your small bookstores and order it there, because these bookstores are really, they need to know that this is out there, but also giving them the support so they can hang around so that they are not taken over or have to shut down. And my website, edienathan.com, edienathan.com. It's pretty easy. And if you want to know a little bit more about the new book, you can go to sexualgrief.com. And that's just a brand new topic. And I know that Dave and I will talk about it at some point.
Absolutely. Edie, thank you so much for just an enlightening, just a wonderful conversation today. I truly enjoyed it. And when your new book comes out, definitely I'd love to have you back for a follow-up conversation.
I would love that too, Dave. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And with that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.